Our final case of the day is Schreiner v. Friedman Law Offices. You may approach. Again, our final case of the day is Schreiner v. Friedman Law Offices. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Jared Olson. I'm an attorney appearing on behalf of the appellant, Deborah Schreiner. This is our second time in front of this court on this case, so I suspect the court is probably just as familiar with these facts as we are at this point. In brief, obviously, this is an appeal from a legal malpractice action. Ms. Schreiner has alleged and offered evidence into the record that her attorney, Dan Friedman and Friedman Law Offices, breached standard of care in handling and litigating her case, leading up to culminating in a mediation at which point Friedman misled Ms. Schreiner about information about her case and used coercive tactics to bully and threaten her into accepting a settlement. This case at this point was dismissed on summary judgment a second time by the Honorable Judge Zastair, and with all due respect to the retired judge, it was improperly done based on the facts, and the findings were not supported by the evidence. The judge dismissed the case on the finding that the belief that Ms. Schreiner had somehow contradicted her testimony in some way, but a review of the record shows that she was quite clear on how the mediation occurred, both in her original affidavits, then again in her deposition testimony, and finally in the supplemental affidavit that was offered to the district court, but which was expressly ignored by the court in its order.
Wasn't there inconsistency in her deposition testimony, though, after remand, where she was saying that she fired Mr. Friedman, she never accepted the offer, versus what was before this court previously, was that she was coerced into accepting the settlement?
Well,
aren't those entirely different positions?
When you look at the context, first of all, of when those statements were made in her deposition, she was asked if she ultimately accepted the settlement, and she did not ultimately accept the settlement as her testimony. And as the supplemental affidavit explained to the court, what occurred during this mediation was she went into this completely unprepared by Mr. Friedman and was always told by her attorney that you have a good case, it's a solid case. Suddenly an offer comes on the table and the attorney turns against her. He tells her, your case is only worth $45,000. The jury's not going to like you because you're overweight. If you want to go to trial on this, you have to pay me $20,000, which you don't have. Otherwise, you have to take this settlement offer. At that point, Ms. Schreiner, in a very emotional state and very confused, did tell Friedman that if that's all I can get, then that's what I'll have to do, which was stated in her earlier affidavit. When given a few minutes, though, to think it over and had a conversation with her boyfriend, still during the mediation, before anything was agreed to or signed or settled on, she then told Mr. Friedman she did not want to take the settlement. At that point, Mr. Friedman continued to push her into trying to take the settlement until she finally stormed out. At that point, the record is clear that Dan Friedman did accept the settlement offer on her behalf. And when the district court was asked to affirm and enforce the settlement, Judge Wright, in his opinion, on the record, expressly stated that the only reason he affirmed the settlement was because Dan Friedman had the apparent authority as her attorney to accept the settlement agreement, and that the defendants were entitled to rely on Dan Friedman's acceptance. And Judge Wright, in fact, directly said that it doesn't matter for his purposes, and he never evaluated whether Ms. Schreiner actually accepted it or not, and that her only remedy was to go after her attorney in a legal malpractice suit.
But her post-remand deposition, she said she fired him at the mediation, so he wouldn't have had authority by the time they appeared before Judge Wright.
She did tell Mr. Friedman that she fired him, but again, they were in separate rooms from the other side, and Ms. Schreiner doesn't know what discussions took place after she left, but if the other side, for some reason, as they seem to have, they told the court in the previous case, believed that Dan Friedman was still acting as Ms. Schreiner's attorney, then they apparently, under Judge Wright's decision, were entitled to rely on Dan Friedman.
Well, here's something I'm curious about, too. In her post-remand deposition, she said she fired Mr. Friedman at the mediation, but at the hearing to enforce the settlement, Mr. Friedman had filed a motion to withdraw, and didn't she resist it?
Ms. Schreiner resisted it on the grounds that she believed, overall, in general, that she did not, that she had not authorized the settlement. She resisted insofar as Mr. Friedman was attempting to take money out of a settlement she didn't want to, that she did not agree to.
It was a motion to withdraw as her attorney. She's now saying she'd fired him before they even got to that hearing, but the record shows us that she resisted him withdrawing as her attorney at that hearing. So it's very confusing.
And I'm sure there are certainly some inconsistencies in the testimony. However, none of them rise to the level of a contradiction or any kind of estoppel argument. More to the point, honestly, regardless of any inconsistencies on this issue about whether or not she accepted the settlement agreement or it was done without her permission, for the purposes of summary judgment, it's simply irrelevant, Your Honor.
Because what does your complaint plead? What does your complaint plead happened?
Our complaint states that Mr. Friedman breached the standard of care in failing to properly litigate and investigate her claims leading up to the mediation.
Okay, and nobody's dealing with that here today.
Right.
I'm looking at it, and I see Ms. Schreiner relented under the pressure and duress and told Mr. Friedman in anger that if that's all she had to get, that's what she'd have to get, exactly what you just said a minute ago. And then, notwithstanding his coerced authority, he accepted the proposal. But then it seems that now she's saying, well, he didn't have authority, and that he acted without authority, but you plead the other. And aren't those two theories inconsistent? And then secondly, where in the complaint is it, does it exist that this acting without authority ever happened?
Your Honor, I mean, I agree that there are some inconsistencies in Ms. Schreiner's testimony, but our position is that those inconsistencies create questions of fact and will go to weigh against Ms. Schreiner's credibility when it comes to trial time. The jury will have to weigh her side of the story and her testimony and credibility. But for the purposes of summary judgment, regardless of whether she accepted a settlement offer under duress from her attorney or whether her attorney took a settlement offer without permission, either scenario is clear malpractice and is a breach of the standard of care.
But is it pled?
I don't have the complaint in front of me right now, Your Honor. I believe that there was a statement in there stating that Mr. Friedman accepted the settlement without her approval, and it also stated, I mean...
Well, your complaint that I see says notwithstanding his coerced authority. There's nothing about acting without authority that I'm seeing, and maybe you can show me where I'm missing something.
And it may not be in the current complaint. However, Your Honor, I would also state that at the time that we've had our second appeal now, we've only had enough time for three depositions and maybe a little bit of document discovery. If we were under a standard scheduling order without these appeals, we certainly would have been able to amend to add that into our complaint based on her testimony. It's certainly not a bar that would grant summary judgment. Simply, it would be a matter that could be cured by amendment.
Okay.
But furthermore, not only is the issue on this one issue irrelevant, but neither case, regardless of whether she accepted the settlement at the mediation under duress or not, that does not mitigate or relieve Friedman from liability for the poor litigation, failure to provide information, and misrepresentations he made to her that put her in that position where she had to make that decision without the necessary information. And regardless of whether she accepted it or not, she was put in that situation and was damaged by the prior malpractice that occurred during and prior to the mediation, and that is still, she has provided a prima facie case with her claims as well as, at this point, uncontroverted expert testimony corroborating that.
I think the problem here, and I'm sorry I'm going to intrude on your saved rebuttal time, but the problem here is that, as I understand it, the district court judge used the Monson principle standard to say this is so inconsistent that I can strike the supplemental affidavit, I can rely on what was said in the deposition. And what she said in the deposition is that she fired Mr. Friedman, and that is not consistent with what was pled. It doesn't support her pleadings then, so there are no material issues of fact. If you strike the last affidavit and you rely strictly on her deposition, there are no material issues of fact to support the pleading of coercion. You can't coerce, like the judge said. You can't be coerced into a settlement if you've already fired your attorney.
Well, initially, Your Honor, if you're going with the statements that were made in the deposition that she fired her attorney and did not authorize a settlement, the record shows that Friedman accepted it anyway, and that right there would be malpractice. But if you look at the pleadings and the summary judgment that the court actually entered, they struck the deposition testimony because they said it was inconsistent with prior affidavits. If the court had properly applied judicial estoppel, they would have had to strike the statement where she said she fired him and force her to rely on the previous statement where she was coerced into a settlement. But the court did neither and decided to strike all statements and dismiss the whole case. So I believe even on that grounds, doctrines of judicial estoppel, equitable estoppel, law of the case were all misapplied. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Renee Eveland of Klein Williams Law Firm, on behalf of the Friedman Appellees, and my clients are here today, Dan Friedman and Herb Friedman. The court knows you've seen this case before. I was asked to be involved in 2016 post-remand. And I heard a lot of people here today say, I don't know, I'm not a trial counsel. I am. I wrote this brief. I took that deposition. I filed this summary judgment. I know what happened. And it was important for me to come and not send this over to appellate counsel. I wanted to be the one to talk with you today about these facts. The case is now on a factual record that is an about face. And when I got the case assigned to me, so to speak, could you be involved in this, I sat with the 2016 opinion and I had to ascertain what had this court said this case was going to be about and what was this case not going to be about, and that's what I want to touch on briefly in this argument. The case was clearly going to be about whether Ms. Schreiner had been coerced into accepting the settlement, or whether she had acted upon the negligent advice given to her. The about face, of course, comes when discovery is underway, and I thought to myself, well, I'm going to explore her level of sophistication. I'm going to explore in what ways did she feel coerced. And that's when the about face came, as we've been talking about already here today. She says not only no, but emphatically no, and if the court will pardon H-E double hockey sticks, no, she did not accept this settlement. That was unequivocal testimony. And I want to touch on something, Justice Bishop, that you asked about this idea that, that the trial court had struck the affidavit or should instead have struck the deposition. That isn't what happened. And if we go to the supplemental affidavit, by the way, was prepared 3 days before the hearing and handed to me at the hearing, at summary judgment hearing. Yeah, I didn't point this out in my brief, but as I was preparing today, paragraph 25. The affidavit was received into evidence, and so it's exhibit 19, paragraph 25. It says, quote, I did not accept the $45,000 offer during mediation. Okay, that's what she had said during her deposition. Next clause. And any actions I am purported to have taken during the mediation were done in reliance on Dan Friedman's advice regarding the value and strength of my case. That paragraph alone cannot be justified within itself. How is it that someone could say, I did not accept the $45,000? She had to say that, right, because she's now said it in the deposition to me, unequivocally. But then she has to somehow save this. This is attorney drafting. And that segues actually to a point that you made, Justice Arterburn, if I may just circle back to that. You asked a question about what does the complaint say? And we're here on the amended complaint. It's the exact same complaint that went to this court on the first appeal. There's an interesting twist here. It's taken three affidavits and a deposition to get this so-called complete testimony. But there are two complaints. There was an initial complaint, and it was coupled with an original affidavit. And on the eve of that summary judgment hearing, the first go-around, or you or I were ever involved in any of this, there was an amendment to the affidavit and an amendment to the complaint. Those original two pieces of pleadings said that Dan Friedman had defrauded her and accepted without her authority. They were then amended to say that isn't what happened. Well, why did that happen? I can tell you why. Because at that point in time, her attorneys had gotten the testimony from Judge Wright, right? The transcript is now available, and now we have a stage that's set, and we have under oath testimony. We have a woman who is represented by separate counsel resisting a motion to withdraw as an attorney. And she, at that point in time, with that stage set, with Dan Friedman, who's already explained to the judge exactly what has happened leading up to that point, she is asked by her attorney, did you sign anything accepting the settlement? She says, no, I didn't sign anything that day. And then the very next question is the kind of key question. Did you, you know, authorize this settlement? And to her own attorney in front of Judge Wright, she says, if that's all I have to get, then that's what I'm going to have to get. And the court moves on. Now, there's been some suggestion that she didn't ask some follow-up questions. But Judge Wright just said, I don't want to hear what you were thinking in your mind. I want to hear what you said out loud. And what you said out loud was, if that's all I'm going to have to get, then that's what I'll have to get. And then the rest of this goes on. And so again, when I'm reading that 2016 opinion, it is 10 lines in that this court has concluded that she settled her case. Why did the court conclude that? Because that was what the theories had been all along. And I offered her brief to this court. We're getting a long record, right? But I want to make clear to the trial judge, now Judge Vestera on remand, she has taken this position all the way to the Court of Appeals. Exhibit 15, page 15, through her lawyer says she accepted the settlement, she was coerced into accepting that settlement, and did so. So that is why 10 lines into your opinion, you have said she's here taking the position that she was coerced into a settlement and the rest of the litigation proceeds. So we're asking that the court affirm. This court has determined already that the case will not be about whether or not she accepted the settlement.
Okay,
that's the law of the case.
So let's just stop for a minute here and discuss how this succeeds on summary judgment, right? We can all agree there's clearly inconsistencies in what this plaintiff has alleged. But how does that survive summary judgment? The fact that she has been inconsistent, you know, as I said to opposing counsel, it appears the judge applied Momsen to disregard certain facts and decide the case on summary judgment as to the pleadings and the deposition testimony that was available because the deposition testimony could not support the pleadings, right?
Right.
But if he allowed the supplemental affidavit where she tries to explain the confusion, that makes it more complicated. So how does this survive summary judgment?
Yeah, so the reason that it ends up on summary judgment, and I want to be clear that what the judge did is not strike anything, not disregard anything. I know that word was used, but if you read the whole thing, what Judge Vestera is saying is, I've looked at everything, and when I line it up side by side, I can't make it mutually consistent.
But don't you have to believe one or the other, and isn't that for a fact finder to decide?
Definitely not. Definitely not.
Why not?
A party cannot create its own question of fact. And in the very last paragraph of my appellate brief, I cite an Eighth Circuit court that talks a lot about that. Because if any party could be the source of creating a dispute of fact, this
her inconsistency creates a new disputed fact, arguably. There were already disputed facts on whether or not she was coerced into taking the agreement.
She cannot create her own dispute of fact because the two theories are so inconsistent they can't proceed. And so I guess the way that you have to think through it, or the way that I thought through it, is think about it logistically. I cannot impeach her on the deposition at trial because she has said, I didn't take the settlement. So that shuts down coercion. That shuts down she relied on any advice. She says, absolutely no, I didn't. So I'm left to impeach her on affidavits that were drafted by attorneys. I have to depose attorneys. How did these inconsistencies come to be? I don't know how else how I would impeach her.
You have her affidavits, you have her pleadings.
But they're inconsistent with what she says in the deposition.
We don't know yet what she'll say at trial.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly the kind of stuff that the law does not allow. Does not allow playing fast and loose with the facts to create your own set of facts.
Those are really extreme remedies, the judicial estoppel, equitable estoppel to some degree. I mean, and that's essentially what this trial judge did, is relied on those estoppel principles because she was inconsistent.
Coupled with the law of the case, of course, confined to...
Well, this court didn't decide the case, right? This court said you could not decide whether or not there was negligence on summary judgment and sent it back. And,
right.
And now before having the facts developed, we're back again on summary judgment.
But this court did say what would not be an issue on remand.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And that's not what we're talking about here.
Right. Well, it is only in the sense that if those are the confined issues, then that's what the case is going to be about. We're too far in to be changing these things. Moreover, it requires realizing that these two things are not alternative theories. They can't proceed side by side. It can't be fraud, and it can't also separately be not fraud, but coercion. Because one means I did not accept the settlement, and you defrauded me. And think how different the road would be that we were on today if that had been brought up at any point in time, including to this court.
Well, it sounds like you may have very strong arguments to make if this were ever to proceed to trial. But isn't it a problem that it was decided on summary judgment? Because the theory is that there was negligence. The facts have changed. There are issues that way. But the theory is that the attorney was negligent.
I think there is no better summary judgment circumstance than this, where it is the person's own testimony that is changed and is trying to create, to meet the exigencies of litigation, to save the case, to change the case, to take the $45,000 once upon a time and now say, whoops, I want to undo that. If this had been fraud from the get-go, if Judge Wright had been alerted to that, if she would have explained that, represented by counsel, then the whole trajectory of this would have changed. It means that when she told Attorney Lannon, the defense attorney in the original underlying case, she told him that he was defrauding her because she was not taking the settlement. The adjuster, Dan Friedman, all acting in some collusive fraud before Judge Wright, my goodness, the road would be totally different today. So this isn't a case where I'm changing my mind about where the headlights were, you know, that case that was cited in the brief. Changing my mind about where I saw the headlights of the car before the impact. This is fundamentally a difference in trajectory of the case. Thank you.
How much did we take Ms. Eveland over? Would you add that to appellant's time, Mr. Olson, if you would like that time?
Judge Bishop, I think you hit the nail right on the head that while there may be inconsistencies with Ms. Schreiner's testimony, these are fact questions for a jury. Ms. Eveland has tried to say we're too far into this case to address these now, but reality is if you set aside the two appeals we've had so far, all we've taken is three depositions. We haven't had any expert designation deadlines. We haven't even set a scheduling order yet because we haven't had time. There's plenty of time for to do actual discovery and dig into what the facts are and what occurred. And then when it comes to trial, the jury will be left to determine the credibility and the weight of the evidence. There are no other questions. I will.
I will
submit.
All right. Thank you both very much. The matter is submitted and you are excused.